series this week on Blake's Images of God. The series title is called Not in That Image of God, Blake's Contrary Visions. And the second half of that is today's title, Blake's Contrary Visions of God. And what I would like you to do for a minute for me is just close your eyes or keep them open and picture a visual image of God, one that is your typical image that comes to your mind. If you think in visual terms of God, and let me just ask you, when you think of God, what is your picture? The picture that you've got in mind. Anybody? What do you see? Is it describable even?
I see God in the sky.
Yeah. So up somehow.
I always think of the image of that on the Sistine Chapel ceiling.
Yeah. I think, and that's an answer I would expect, I think, because that's the dominant image of God we've got in Western society. Michelangelo puts a stamp on it. And I think, in spite of perhaps feminist critiques of male images of God, that still is the dominant image, whether we even want to think in those terms or not. I tend not to want to think in those terms, and yet when I think of God, that's what I picture. And I've got a couple slides of the Sistine Chapel depictions here, and what I'd like to do is remind you of that, even though we're all very, very familiar with Michelangelo, to then get to Blake, because Blake's image of God has very much in mind Michelangelo's, and what Blake does with his images is what I want to get to today. Could someone flip on the slide machine for me, please?
Covers a lot of Moses, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's... This is a set, not the whole ceiling, but a set of Michelangelo's creation. So the pictures from Genesis, there's God creating light, let there be light. And God separating the waters from the firmament. And there's God as bearded old man. And there's the picture I think we have in mind. God creating Adam, fingers not quite touching, lots of other stuff going on. Adam reclining on the earth, God being held up by hosts of angels. And I think, I mean, for me, if you can expunge perhaps feminist critiques of images of God for a minute, and I think that's a wonderful celebration of humanity and spirituality, the mystery of creation both. So that's Michelangelo. There's God up close, being held up by the angels. And then here is the scene of creation of Eve from Genesis 2, and the temptation scene, the fall happening, and the expulsion then from Eden over there on the right. It took Michelangelo 4 years to do that, and 1512 is when he completed it. You remember the stars, when he was working on that, he'd get mail, his correspondence, and he'd get a letter and try to read it, Dear Mike, and he couldn't, he'd have to hold it above his head like this to even read, because he was so used to being on it, looking up above his head. Blake's version of the same thing didn't take as long to do, and it's not as enormous, but it's very much influenced, and what I'd like to do is take a tour through Blake's version of Genesis, the fall, and focusing in particular on his view of God, the creator God, to see what he has to say about it, and to then to look at some of the differences between Michelangelo's Renaissance version and Blake's early modern version of God and the fall. And one word about Blake's. Blake's comes by way of John Milton's Paradise Lost. So he's doing Michelangelo, but he's thinking Milton, and Milton's retelling of that story in Paradise Lost, so it's got some different elements in it. That's, again, Michelangelo, the last expulsion. And here's Blake's version. He tells the whole story of Paradise Lost, so this is the war in heaven taking place, with Jesus at the head of the armies of heaven, routing the legions of sin and death. And that's just a close-up of some of Satan's followers going down. There's Blake's version of Michelangelo's famous picture. And I want to come back to that one. Let's take a look. The Blake's title is Elohim Creating Adam. Then in the rest of Blake's version of this, you get the creation of Eve taking place there. Sleeping Adam. And there's Satan now, once Adam and Eve have been created, admiring them, wondering at them, and planning his plots. This is a close-up of Satan. And then there are the angels admiring the two also. And this is Adam and Eve being instructed then in the garden by Raphael. And there's Blake's version of the temptation.
It looks like a precursor to Heart in the Middle.
Yeah, it does. That one's fairly sparse. Then, rest of the story. After that, God makes plans to send Jesus down and do the redeeming. So there's Jesus volunteering.
That's all out of Paradise Lost.
Yeah, right. And then this is back on Earth. Adam and Eve get told about the horror that's going to get created because of them, and then yet the wonder of Jesus dying for their sins. So they get the whole plot laid out in front of them, feel terrible about it, and then get chucked out of paradise. And that's the two getting led out. Okay, so that's a quick run through of Blake's version of it. And what I'd like to do is, if you can bear with me for a second, to get those two slides back out of Michelangelo's Creation of Adam and Blake's. Have you do some comparing for me of the differences you see. I don't have double copy, so I have to do this. See if it worked. Okay, there's Michelangelo again. Just look at that for a second, and I'll flash back and forth. There's Blake's. So what differences, what's Blake up to that Michelangelo is not?
Well, Blake's Adam looks like he's already in trouble.
Yeah, no. In trouble. He looks sick, terrible, down there. Yeah. And Michelangelo's is this wonderful humanistic expression.
What is that curled around in it? I mean, that looks like a serpent.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. The serpent body already around Adam.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like he's already trapped.
Yeah. So in the creation itself, Adam is, the plot set is already trapped by Satan, and the fall takes place immediately upon the creation.
But it doesn't look like a garden. It looks like he's being created out of nothing.
Yeah.
In chaos.
Yeah.
In chaos. Not being made out of earth, like the story goes.
Yeah, you've got water all around here.
Looks like water.
The recently created sun is there from Genesis back there, but no garden. Although I think Adam does look like Adam's emerging out of, and that's sort of the separation of the firmament from the water is Adam. Adam as earth itself. And I don't know if you can see in the picture here, but God's left hand is reaching over for something. Can you see that? I mean, that's the timing of this creation is different from this one. That one, Adam has just been created. The wonderful mystery has been transacted. Adam's alive there. And it's often described as if Adam has just woken up from sleep. And Blake's, this is sort of a Frankenstein monster. He hasn't put the brain in yet. And that's what that dirt clod is over there. He's got the dirt, God's got the dirt clod. He's about to give Adam a brain transplant. Put it in to make Adam human. You've all seen Young Frankenstein. That's the brain, whether it's Abby Normal's brain or what. But it's sort of a horrific scene, which
there's power there, but there isn't beauty. There's beauty in it.
Yeah. I think that's good. It's certainly power, dramatic, something, and the message of the two is quite different, isn't it? What's Blake's point there? If that's God, what's Blake saying about God and the creation?
It's clear that evil as well as good are very important to Blake.
Yeah.
Whereas Michael, or you know, sin, and perhaps that sin comes from God, whereas Michelangelo doesn't insinuate that at all. His Michelangelo's painting is purely goodness.
Yeah. You don't see. In the creation itself, you don't see precursors of the fall at all.
It's like Blake doesn't believe in the fall. He believes that there's always fallen to an extent.
Yeah, and Blake is preoccupied with the fall, and that's central to his myth. And everything he does, he's got that in mind. So even at that creation that you see there, the fall is taking place, and that's. Yeah, a couple other ways to sort out some of the difference. This basic art historian's descriptions of Michelangelo say that it's sort of a peak expression of human dignity and grandeur in its illustration of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. And then Adam's waking as if from sleep. And there's this Italian Renaissance notion of sprezzatura, that is tossing off the most difficult feat imaginable with the ease as if you were bending over to tie your shoe. And I think that's a good illustration of sort of that concept. God doing the creation, this wonderful creation, as if it was no great task. And Adam's response is the same, as if nothing has really happened. It's just, that's the way things are. It's sprezzatura. And again, God as an old man. Blake's, on the other hand, what you get is God the Father, God as old man. And this is Blake's technique always, is to take things literally. And literally to him means to read them in their significance. And what he does, he takes Michelangelo's God literally and says, God is, you're right, an old man. And this is the old man in Michelangelo's God. And it's not necessarily the wonderful creator God that Michelangelo had in mind, even though Michelangelo recognized it by putting the stamp on Western views of God. God's this old man. Blake says, you're absolutely right, although your attitude towards it isn't quite right, so Blake will correct that attitude. And this is Blake's nobo daddy. That's God the Father, who is nobody's father, nobody's daddy. He's old, and this is described. God's tired, he's spent, he's created the world already, he's done everything else. He's still got Adam and Eve to go, but he's had it. And And as a result, he's not making mistakes here. And some Native American creation myths are funny. God keeps making mistakes and then finally gets some things right. But here, he's at work. Creation is painful. And what he makes is a zombie without the brain yet. But I think what's interesting is the zombie is made in God's image. And part of the ironic point is that zombie without a brain is already in God's image.
But also it's already corrupted, even before he's finished, evil already sets in. He hasn't yet got... he hasn't even sinned yet, has he?
Yeah, I think that's... And what that means, if that Adam is created in God's image, that God is evil too, is part of the point. And part of Blake's point is that God doesn't have a brain, just as Adam doesn't, because they look the same. And there's a couple.
You think you can insinuate that God doesn't have a brain because Adam doesn't?
Well, I think that's part of Blake's dark humor. Here's Adam with no brain yet, already looking exactly like that God.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely looked, God's in a trance, and Adam doesn't look like... he looks... I wouldn't have thought that he was not formed yet. I would have thought he was just in a trance, too.
Yeah.
But, God looks blind to me.
Yeah, he does.
He's not looking at where he's... what he's doing.
And we'll see in some of Blake's other versions of this thing that God often is described as crawling around in the dark, doesn't know where things are. And that's... So a couple interpretive points just about this, I think. Thinking about Blake's literal imagination. Blake's thinking Michelangelo and saying, you're right, Michelangelo, God is this old man. And what we've got here is the creation of material man out of the earth, and that material man without spirit is seen by Blake to be a horror. And that's a creator God in Blake's view that is only of the material world and not of the spirit. And without the spirit, what you get are monsters and zombies. So you get a creator God creating a zombie, and I think that's part of the reason why the brain's not there. That God, and why Blake chooses this moment to depict rather than Michelangelo's, the breath of God's spirit hasn't been blown into this zombie yet, in part because this God doesn't have the breath of God's spirit. That's not quite God. And a couple other points, and this is about Blake's view of creation. Creation to Blake is painful. He's talking about human experience constantly, and in his own artistic experience is painful. And one other infernal point, I think, that Blake is asking to think about in this, that creation for Blake is a two-way street, and that Michelangelo is correct here in depicting that, because that's not only God creating Adam, but that's Adam creating God. And Michelangelo did not have that in mind when he painted that. But I think that's Blake's point, that for Blake, all deities reside in the human breast, and it's as true to say that God is creating Adam as it is to say that Adam is creating God. And I think part of the magic of that picture, that the touch of the fingers close to each other is Blake's fascination with. Michelangelo is right, but he didn't quite understand it. Blake does see it because Blake is this visionary. Let me sort out in Blake's view what all that exactly means then. And the subtitle for today's talk could be not just Blake's contrary visions of God, but why we are walking around upside down. And this is the explanation for why, in Blake's view, we are all upside down. And his cosmology, his base, he's got many different versions of the fall, but what he's got in mind is what he's describing here on this plate in the Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And if I can just read a little bit of that to you, I think it's clear enough you can even read along. On the right panel, there's a depiction of the fall taking place. And Blake is saying, those who restrain desire do so because theirs is weak enough to be restrained, and the restrainer, or reason, usurps its place and governs the unwilling. And being restrained, it by degrees becomes passive till it is only the shadow of desire. The history of this is written in Paradise Lost, and the governor, or reason, is called Messiah. And the original archangel, or possessor of the command of the heavenly host, is called the devil, or Satan, and his children are called sin and death. But in the book of Job, Milton's Messiah is called Satan, for this history has been adopted by both parties. And it goes on in the next plate. It indeed appeared to reason as if desire was cast out. But the devil's account is that the Messiah fell and formed a heaven of what he stole from the abyss. And his final tag on this, it goes on, is this is shown in the gospel where he prays to the Father to send the comforter or desire, he's referring to Gethsemane here, that the reason may have ideas to build on. Point, the Jehovah of the Bible being no other than he who dwells in flaming fire. And what Blake is saying with all that, which is complicated use of mythology, the long and short of it is this, that's a picture of the world after the fall. Now I just stuck the slide in upside down to illustrate it because Blake doesn't have any sort of very clear pictures of that. But what happens at the fall is Adam and Eve, or us, are all walking around on a normal, flat world. After the fall, the world flips upside down. So we're all walking around upside down. And at that moment, what you think is up is really down, and what you think is down is really up. That makes sense? So we still think what's up is up there, but that's really down, because we're upside down. The point of that then is, the God we think is up there, up when we think of God, is really down there. So that the God of organized religion isn't God, it's that monster, and it's Satan. And that's Blake's key point, key to his mythology. The God of organized religion, the God of too many organized religions, is actually Satan, and that's who fallen people worship. And that the true God isn't up there, which is really down there. The true God of Blake is, you could say down there, but there really is no down if you write things right back up. Then the true God is in the picture of Michelangelo's creation, that mystery of God creating Adam and Adam creating God both. And that's the mystery that all deities reside in the human breast. So does that make sense, that upside down business? So that picture of God creating Adam is a picture of God creating after a fall that's taken place, even before the Adam and Eve story. And that God is this Satan materialist figure doing the creation of the material world that is fallen from the start. The organized religion then has this picture of a cosmology of a God that they've got it wrong. So Blake, the prophet, comes in and says, wake up, what you really need to do is see that you're worshiping the wrong deity. And I've got a number of slides here to show Blake's image then of this God that in his critique is the wrong God. And then, of course, he's got an answer, what the correct version of God looks like, which is what I'd like to get to. But the main point is that I think to see that any view of an external sky male God to Blake is an incorrect view of what God is, just as Michelangelo really knew in Blake's mind. Michelangelo knew that, but he didn't see it. Blake sees it. And just as Milton, in writing Paradise Lost, makes Satan the hero because he knew the truth too, but didn't see it. And then Blake begins a whole romantic tradition of saying Satan is more interesting than God in Paradise Lost because Satan is this real power of energy and creation. And the reason God in Milton is this passive force that nobody's interested in. And it's actually, if you just sort of switch the terms around. Any questions about that? Does that make some sense? Start to think like Blake. I get questions sometimes. Does that mean Blake is a Satanist?
Not at all. He's not saying that Satan is God.
Yeah.
He's saying that neither one is God.
Yeah. You know, and that's, I think that's right. He's not a, he's a Christian. What he's saying is that we're all Satanists if we worship that God.
Then we're tricked into it because we're all wrong.
Right.
So does that mean that in his fall, the ultimate deception is the reversal of our perception?
Yeah. And then the way to correct that is to bring about the right side upping of the world. And that's, we'll get to how, in Blake's mind, how some of that can take place. But again, here's another one of his pictures. I showed this yesterday of that creator God. That's our image of God, says Blake, that's the wrong God. And in Blake's myth, he has a name for that God, which he typically calls him, and it's your Rizin, or your reason. And that's your reason. That's the God that reason creates. That imagination doesn't create, that reason creates. Or your horizon, that's the God of the horizon, the God of boundaries and limits, that wants to keep the lid on things, that wants to create a material atom, that wants to create the material world, that's very interested in the material, but not the spiritual. So he leaves the brain out of Adam. And that's also Isaac Newton, the scientist, describing how the cosmos is set up in Blake's time. And Isaac Newton and Satan are the same for Blake. That is also, any materialist you can think of, that's Paul Hansen for praising the deist too much yesterday. Or that's us for thinking scientifically without the other half. Like, that's John Locke. You can bring in lots of Blake's substitutions. This is another view of the same thing from his Book of Urizen. That's Jehovah from the Bible writing the Ten Commandments. And Blake's Book of Urizen is this wonderfully powerful, confusing combination of Genesis and Revelation tied up into one, which I'm not going to attempt to read anything but just one little quick paragraph to you. And Blake starts this thing off. Lo, a shadow of horror is risen in eternity, unknown, unprolific, self-closed, all-repelling. What demon hath formed this abominable void, this soul-shuddering vacuum? Some said, it is your horizon, but unknown, abstracted, brooding, secret, the dark power hid. And in the Book of Urizen, sort of Blake's Genesis and Revelation, what he goes on to do is tell a story about how this deity appears somehow after this fall has taken place. So God shows up, creates the Ten Commandments, says everybody needs to follow these Ten Commandments. Then an Adam figure appears, which in Blake's myth is called Los, L-O-S. And all the details of this, I think, you can get lost in the details, but I think some of the elements of this are helpful. So what happens then, Urizen's there, and all he is this big spine, a backbone, that starts thrashing around and starts to create the material world. And then Los, God's son, Adam, like Michelangelo knew, Blake says, creates the body of God. He builds the material body of God around Urizen. And then comes the creation of Eve. God, Adam, or Los, sees this body of God that he's created and pities it because it's so horrible. And out of pity grows Eve, Blake's feminine principle, by Los, Adam splitting in half. And then people are created. And then Urizen crawls around blind like he is in the vision of Elohim creating Adam. And by creeping around, creates the rest of the material world and builds what Blake calls the net of religion. And then at the end of the Book of Urizen, people shrink into hard little frozen things that see only from their material senses. And there you've got the creation of the world that Blake saw around him, that people like Isaac Newton were emphasizing reason and the material world only. Another, this is that same God Urizen with his son, Los. Los having just created the body of God, an enmity already existing between the two. But this is also Abraham about to sacrifice Isaac. Same thing, same story. Or that's, in the poem we talked about yesterday, that's the jealous God in the poison tree and the enemy about to be killed. Another vision, same thing. In this image in Blake is titled Nebuchadnezzar from, is that Daniel like it's described? Which, what's the story of Nebuchadnezzar?
In that story, he attempts to be equal to God, and God casts him down and induces him with madness, and he creeps and crawls like animals.
Yeah, gets turned into an animal. So here you've got Blake's version of that. That's God. God's creep. This is your rising figure, creeping around like an animal, because that's not God in himself. And again, that's. You could substitute lots of different names for that same myth, but that's this animal god that doesn't have spirituality in him. A couple other views of this wrong, contrary vision of God. On the right, you can see there's that same bearded old man, Michelangelo-esque figure. Here, tied down to the material earth by his own hair, sort of spreading the nets of religion. And on the left, one of Blake's famous poems from the Songs of Experience, London, the same old, decrepit old man here with a crutch being led by a child. And the words of this poem are connected to this image. Can you read those? He says, I wander through each chartered street, near where the chartered Thames does flow, and mark in every face I meet, marks of weakness, marks of woe. In every cry of every man, in every infant's cry of fear, in every voice, in every ban, the mine-forged manacles I hear. How the chimney sweepers cry, every blackening church appalls, and the hapless soldier's sigh runs in blood down palace walls. But most through midnight streets I hear how the youthful harlot's curse blasts the newborn infant's tear and blights with plagues the marriage hearse. Again, there's that gloomy, terrible picture that's a description of 18th century England to Blake, but it's also a description of 18th century religious spirituality, which to Blake is dead. Now, it's not all gloom and doom and horror for Blake. There is this wonderful vision. And part of the vision is revealed in that slide. The Savior is the child. And that's one of his images for true God. True God isn't Urizen, it's the child in that figure. And that's just another sort of image of the mind-forged manacles of Urizen. And another, Blake has a number of visions of true God. The child is one. His other is the son of God, Los. And this is a picture of Los, which is this revolutionary fighter that's fighting against this father figure that wants to kill him like Jehovah or like Abraham going to kill his son Isaac. And Blake's Los fights back. And he's this revolutionary figure that creeps through all of Blake's myths and illuminated pages. Also, the hero for Blake is Jesus. And I don't know if you remember back at the beginning of this when I was running through his version of Paradise Lost. The creator God, after God created Adam, the one who was creating Eve out of Adam, did you see that when that went by? That was Jesus doing that. And Blake substitute Jesus and Jesus' image for God as the correct version. And it's Jesus, it's the child, it's Los, that is this savior figure. And the key is it's any union of the spiritual and the material, both. And it has to be the two. It's the incarnate God, Jesus, it's you, it's Michelangelo's recognition in that creation, seeing the creation goes both ways. And that's how it gets done. And what needs to get done is to turn the world right side up, to recognize again that all deities reside in the human breast, or, as I was saying yesterday about Blake, that everything depends upon your point of view, so you need to change your point of view. Or, to use the end of Jesus' parable from Luke, take heed how you hear, how you see things. Now, with the time left, I'd like to get back to Songs of Innocence and Experience and take a look at a couple more of Blake's poems, looking at experience and also the innocence side of things. And I think maybe this can help clarify some of the complexities of Blake's mythologies and images of God, because in the songs, things still remain fairly simple. And I'd like to start with the poem that's The Human Abstract, which was that one on the right. Can you read that? Let me read that to you. This is a poem from the Songs of Experience. Blake says, "Pity would be no more if we did not make somebody poor, and mercy no more could be if all were as happy as we. And mutual fear brings peace till the selfish loves increase. Then cruelty knits a snare and spreads his baits with care. He sits down with holy fears and waters the ground with tears. Then humility takes root underneath his foot. Soon spreads the dismal shade of mystery over his head, and the caterpillar and fly feed on the mystery. And it bears the fruit of deceit, ruddy and sweet to eat. And the raven his nest is made in its thickest shade. The gods of the earth and sea sought through nature to find this tree, but their search was all in vain. There grows one in the human brain." So there you've got that same gloomy image. The Song of Innocence that's paired with that, it's The Way Out, is called The Divine Image. And that's the one there on the left. And in The Divine Image, Blake says, "To mercy, pity, peace, and love, all pray in their distress. And to these virtues of delight, return their thankfulness. For mercy, pity, peace, and love is God, our Father dear. And mercy, pity, peace, and love is man, his child, and care. For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, and peace the human dress. Then every man of every clime that prays in his distress, prays to the human form divine, love, mercy, pity, peace. And all must love the human form in heathen, Turk, or Jew, where mercy, love, and pity dwell, there God is dwelling too." The question then that the Songs of Innocence and Experience and Blake's whole vision of God really is it depends upon your point of view which of those two ways of seeing it's going to be. The problem is, once you hear the Song of Experience saying there wouldn't be pity if we didn't make people poor in the first place, how do you even get to that position of experience from the position of us in the world? Is it possible to read poems of innocence without any hints of cynicism in them? And that's a real question, both in reading Blake's poems of innocence and his point about life. How do you get to that point of innocence when most people are living in that fallen world? Is it possible to read The Divine Image and say that's right after you've heard Blake say there wouldn't be pity if we didn't make poor people in the first place? And I think you can see that in a couple more pairings here. And this is Holy Thursday, on the right. This is a song of innocence. It says, 'Twas on a holy Thursday, their innocent faces clean, the children walking two and two in red and blue and green. Gray-headed beetles walked before with wands as white as snow, till into the high dome of Paul's they like the Thames waters flow. Oh, what a multitude they seemed, these flowers of London town. Seated in companies they sit with radiance all their own. The hum of multitudes was there, but multitudes of lambs, thousands of little boys and girls raising their innocent hands. Now, like a mighty wind, they raise to heaven the voice of song, or like harmonious thunderings, the seats of heavens among. Beneath them sit the aged men, wise guardians of the poor. Then cherish pity, lest you drive an angel from your door. And that's the innocent version of that. And the song of experience that's paired with that is the one that's up there. Blake says, is this a holy thing to see in a rich and fruitful land? Babes reduced to misery, fed with a cold and usurious hand. Is that trembling cry a song? Can it be a song of joy? And so many children poor, it is a land of poverty. And their sun does never shine, and their fields are bleak and bare, and their ways are filled with thorns. It is eternal winter there. For where'er the sun does shine, and where'er the rain does fall, babe can never hunger there, nor poverty the mind appall. And what both those are describing, I don't know if it's hard for poetry to sink in when you're sitting here having somebody read it to you, but both those are describing a scene in London every year. The city fathers would gather up all the poor orphans in town and pray them down to St. Paul's Cathedral for the celebration. And they'd fill the church and they would sing, and it would part be this celebration of some of the new laws set up to help impoverished kids and set up orphan places. So it's this wonderful celebration of the benevolence of humankind. And Blake is sort of, in the song of innocence, praising the wonder and innocence of children's views of God. But the song of experience, he's saying, what's going on here is simply people prating their benevolence in front of others, saying, look how good we are, when they're the ones responsible for all the poverty in the first place. Then the question again that gets raised is, how do you turn the world right side back? How do you get a correct image of God? Where is there one? Is it in the children's view of things? And after you read the song of experience, can you still get back to innocence? And let me just read again that song of innocence of Holy Thursday, because I think part of Blake's point always is there, just as in God's creation of Adam has the serpent around it from the start, innocence has always this possibility of this other view, depending upon our point of view. If I can find it again. This is a song of innocence, Holy Thursday. And what I'd like you to do is ask you, is there a cynical tone at all in this, or not? 'Twas on a holy Thursday, their innocent faces clean, the children walking two and two in red and blue and green. Gray-headed beetles, that's the police, walked before with wands as white as snow, till into the high dome of Paul's they like Thames water flow. Oh, what a multitude they seem, these flowers of London town. Seated in companies, they sit with radiance all their own. The hum of multitudes was there, but multitudes of lambs, thousands of little boys and girls raising their innocent hands. Now, like a mighty wind, they raise to heaven the voice of song, or like harmonious thunderings, the seats of heaven among. Beneath them sit the aged men, wise guardians of the poor. Then cherish pity, lest you drive an angel from your door. Now, when Blake writes that, is he being cynical at all in that poem, or is that pure innocence, do you think?
That there's a certain tone of cynicism in the fact that the kids are regimented,
yeah.
which we know that Blake is very opposed to. They're George and walking two and two, and red and blue and green. And then there's the grey-headed beetle walking with wands as white as snow, which seems to be an instrument of aggression. And then in the last stanza, the grey-headed beetles are sitting beneath them, beneath the kids, as if they're morally beneath the children. So I've always read it as being a very ironic attack on these beetles, these wise guardians of the poor.
So you don't even need the song Experience, which is saying outright what that poem already seems to be saying. And that's, you've got these cops hauling these kids in there and saying, sit down here and look sharp and let's have everybody feel good about the fact that we're helping you today.
And they're being driven like lambs. You, I think, would see the image of lambs being driven to the market for slaughter.
Yeah.
At least I would, that struck me as one of the metaphors.
Yeah, and just the fact you've got policemen with wands as white as snow is these.
I think that line kind of steps out, and it's just simple sarcasm. He's not trying very hard to hide.
Yeah, and I guess simple sarcasm. I think in Blake, and he wrote these. He wrote the Songs of Experience 1793, Songs of Innocence 1789, quite a ways apart. And I'm not sure he was being cynical when he first wrote that, but it's certainly there. And again, part of the point is it depends on our point of view and how much cynicism we want to read it with. I think ideally, Blake would want that those children's innocent view to be salvation. Ideally, to be able to read that poem with no cynicism.
Quite telling, because before you explain on the St. Paul's, I heard Paul as in funeral Paul.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Being driven.
Yeah, and Blake puns on that also. In that London poem, he does use the word Paul.
I think it's hard for us, too, post-Dickens, not to read a little bit of Charles Dickens' appraisal of philanthropy in London at his time.
Right.
I mean, that would be, what, 30, 40 years later, or...?
Yeah, this is 1793, and then...
Or more than that. Is like Bleak House.
Right, and that's much later.
Though. Yeah.
1860.
Yeah, there's one more pairing that I'd like to look at. This is Infant Joy and Infant Sorrow. Let me see if I can find it again. I'd like to... let's end with a happy note.
Yeah.
We'll do Infant Sorrow first. That's on the left.
Can we still ask unhappy questions?
Can you?
Unhappy questions.
This is Infant Sorrow first. My mother groaned, my father wept, into the dangerous world I leapt. Helpless, naked, piping loud, like a fiend hid in a cloud. Struggling in my father's hands, striving against my swaddling bands, bound and weary, I thought best to sulk upon my mother's breast. Okay, real short, quick, and then there's the illustration of this screaming child. And the illustration doesn't seem to reveal a whole lot there, actually. But that little quick poem, I think what's interesting about Blake's sort of myth is 1793 he wrote that, and that mirrors sort of his whole mythic thought throughout his whole life. In that little poem is the whole story of the Book of Urizen, about this child of Urizen that in the plot of that thing gets creates God, and then they have this enmity, gets tied down to this cliff, and it tries to sacrifice the son, and sort of in the world of experience. And this is me 2 hours ago trying to get my daughter to go down for a nap, changing her diapers. She's fighting on the bed. I have to sit on top of her and hold her arms down too. And this is the same type of mentality, I think. I wonder what she thinks. Here's this monster holding her down saying, stop wiggling. And that's That's infant sorrow.
Maybe she's saying, but then again, he's a Blake scholar. So.
I'm sure that's taken all
yeah, what can you
think?
Yeah,
let's hope. That's infant sorrow, again, to get this back to where we started, that's a description of the creation of Blake's vision of God with Elohim creating Adam. I mean, that's the same mentality. My mother groaned, my father wept, into the dangerous world I left. That's creation of Adam as being painful. Infant joy, then, is there on the right. Another simple, I think, deceivingly simple poem. I have no name, I am but 2 days old. What shall I call thee? I happy am. Joy is my name, sweet joy befall thee. Pretty joy, sweet joy, but 2 days old, sweet joy I call thee. Thou dost smile, I sing the while, sweet joy befall thee. And there's two speakers in that poem. There's this infant singing, and then there's somebody responding to it. Let me read that one more time. I have no name, I am but 2 days old, what shall I call thee? I happy am. Joy is my name, sweet joy befall thee. Pretty joy, sweet joy, but 2 days old, sweet joy I call thee. Thou dost smile, I sing the while, sweet joy befall thee. I think that's Michelangelo's vision of God creating Adam as compared to Blake's. And this is the innocent version, and that's, I think, two-way creation that Blake's talking about there. You've got the child, the parent, engaged in this dialogue together. And the creator, God, parent is asking, who are you? And the child is doing the naming itself. And the God is responding to that in that type of relationship. Child bringing into being the deity, and the deity saying, fine, that's in the sort of caring relationship, that's then what I will call you. You hear anything else in those short 10 lines? How about the question, is there any hint of cynicism or experience in that one? After having heard infant sorrow, this child being born, parents groaning and sulking back upon his mother's breast, is there any hint of domination and oppression in this one? It doesn't seem like it, but there must be.
The repetition of only 2 days old, and that's the only point at which you can be joyful. I know I bring some of that to it, but if that comes up, at that point I can be happy, but
later.
It seems to be we're waiting for the other foot to fall, and the shoe to fall.
Yeah, so I'm but 2 days old, so I'm innocent, but on the third day or the seventh day, things will change.
Well, and also it ends, sweet joy befall thee, this little baby saying, oh, I'm really happy, and it could be a kind of a cynical ending. Well, good luck.
Yeah, good luck. And also the occurrence of the word fall, and that's Blake's, that word is always in Blake's mind. Sweet joy befall thee, and it is implied that, I mean, I think that's some of your point. Befall you, but you will be falling soon if you're not fallen already.
I think also in the illustration, there's this womb-like flower surrounded by this very, very dark, threatening blue. It's almost as if 2 days old, this child is fortunately surrounded by this womb, but it will be there forever. So there's the hint of the suggestion that experience is creeping on.
Yeah.
Well, and are those blossoms also flames? Mm-hmm. Are the petals flames?
Yeah, no, I think that's right, and that's if they look like it. And that's, if the child is unborn, it's not even born into experience yet here, or it's still being purified by the fires of the revolutionary prophet even somehow.
I guess you could even stretch it and say the other bud there is a tear.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the naming that's going on in the poem is bringing the child into a world of categories.
Yeah.
You just can't be. You have to be categorized in a certain way. You have to be able to label you.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, and the way I talk about that same thing is, here's a child. I have no name. I'm 2 days old. God figure says, what shall I call you? That's naming as controlling. That deity wants to then take charge. And response, I am happy. I happy am. Joy is my name. Response, sweet joy befall thee. And then the rest of that, you've got sort of the infant being in control in the first part, but then in the second stanza, already you've got the organization of organized religion taking over. Okay, now we can categorize things and name things, and it says, pretty joy, sweet joy, but 2 days old. I've got this under control, now I can write a Bible about it. Pretty joy, sweet joy, but 2 days old, sweet joy I call thee. Thou to smile, I sing the while, sweet joy befall thee. And you start to get it scripted so that the story can be told and retold.
And are those just leaves, or are those kind of monsters that the child's going to fall prey to in life?
Down below?
Yeah. And those leaves look awfully threatening to me, in some way.
Yeah, and also, I don't know, did they know about Venus flytraps? I think they did, even. I thought about it, but I mean, that's part of, they're about to get snapped up by the material vegetable world that's going to be taking place. And again, that question, is that a poem of pure innocence? Innocence is being salvation. Is there cynicism there? Are we reading it in? Yes, yes to all those. And it depends upon your point of view, and that's Blake's point.
I think you just ruined a nice little poem.
I'm struck by the syntax of the response, I happy am. Mm. Not I am happy, not as a naming, but a description.
Yeah.
When it comes back, it has to be a name. You have to use the syntax of naming.
Yeah, and I think one context for that Blake's got in mind, too, is Moses asking God,
I am.
Who are you? I am. Here, child, I am. That child is God. That's Blake's point, always.
Is it a kind of backwards thing, what I thought of in terms of what shall I call thee? You know, that's what God gives Adam the power to do in Genesis 2,
right.
But in this poem, it's God who is doing this categorizing instead of the human.
Yeah, and that's, and when the child's doing it, I happy am naming itself, that's okay. When God takes over and says, okay, I'll take that name and now use it, mm-hmm. That's when the mistake happens. And that really leads into what I'd like to talk about tomorrow. And just do a quick advertisement. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about Blake's Bible, particularly his use of Proverbs. And so we have a Bible study in the morning, and then we'll do a Blake Bible study, looking at Blake's in the afternoon. And what I'd like to do is look, it's really that notion's at the center of my approach to Blake's Proverbs. This naming, and then names getting used later. Naming is great, but once names get used by other people, you've got a problem. And I'm going to be administering a wisdom quiz. So I'd like to test your wisdom quotient tomorrow. You're double.
Any old
company.
So much of the advertising.
Tomorrow's the test.
It's an easy test.
Oh, good.
Tell you that. No one has failed this yet. But I'd like to fool around with Blake's use of Proverbs. It's really interesting that Blake would use Proverbs at all. For the poet that hates generalizations, hates prudence, hates general wisdom, that would use a proverb, which. That's the definition of a proverb, a statement of general wisdom of the many. And those dynamics, I think, give insight in maybe even easier ways than looking at Blake's mythology, which gets, I think, confusing and over-complex too quickly because all these names of all these weird gods. But so tomorrow we'll look at something nice and specific, lines of wisdom. So.
Has Blake ever been accused of, or has there been studied the element of anti-Judaism in his whole system?
Not that I've read of any.
I could see how it could feed into what was very much a growing phenomenon in England at that time of anti-Judaism, because this is painting the Torah and the God of the Hebrews,
yeah,
of the Jews, as an evil demiurge type of being. And I could see very much that it could lend to demonizing the Jewish population of England.